I was thinking we should do the entire podcast. So forget the books and do the entire podcast on the sad puppy, rabid puppy controversy and read every single article written about it, both blog and mainstream news article, and then do a dissection of every article.
Now, you know I've been trying to keep this podcast under 90 minutes for the last year, right? Don't ruin things for me.
Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a bi-monthly, hopefully soon to be monthly.
Not that soon.
Well, maybe in 2016. podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. I'd like to welcome Kirsten McDermott to the podcast. You may know her from this podcast. Hello, Kirsten.
Hello, Ian.
I'd also like to welcome us to our new studio recording centre called the House of Ori.
Savari. Yeah. I like that. He should put up a sign. Yes,
he should have a little plaque outside his door that says
"The House of Ori."
Correct. So Ori has given us his.
Has he got a pedestrian crossing nearby that we could just walk across with the podcast equipment?
Like the Beatles?
Yeah.
Oh my God. actually. There could be one.
Now you know you want to, right?
Yeah, I do a little bit. So, yes, thank you, Ori, and thank you to Jules for providing brownies.
Oh, which I haven't eaten, so I'll have to wait till we finish.
You can eat them during the podcast.
No, that's gross.
Why? Because it goes like that?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Makes you eat that way. It's exactly the noise you make.
Shut up.
Anywho, it's been 2 months again, and but we're back. I blame you for this because, you know, it's entirely your – how is the PhD going? Do you want to talk about it?
No.
So okay.
It's going fine.
It's either talk about the PhD or talk about sad puppies and Hugo Slates. You can choose.
God, we talked about the sad puppies and the Hugo Slates last time. What we said stands.
I remember. Oh, that's right. Right. Yeah, okay.
Popular award. This is how it could be gamed. Not much you can do about it except encouraging a whole bunch of people to vote the way they want to vote. That's how you fix it, right? That's how you fix it.
Yes.
You encourage everybody else who is upset by what's happened.
And right thinking.
To nominate and vote.
And right thinking.
Stop it. And that's how it's fixed.
Okay. So do you want to link to this Eric Flint article that you mentioned?
It is actually. It's a really, really – it's fairly long, but I think it's worth reading it in its entirety because he does quite – successfully, I think, demolish a lot of the arguments around the state of the Hugo and the Nebulas and other awards in terms of who gets nominated, who wins, who doesn't. He points to several authors who are both very popular and who you would consider left-wing who have never been nominated or at least never won a Hugo and so on. But what's really interesting about the article is that he is looking at the bifurcation between the Hugo and Nebula and other SF awards and the readership of SF books and how they've diverged in recent years. And by recent years, it doesn't mean the last, you know, 4 or 5.
You mean what gets awarded isn't reflected on what's read?
Yes. Yeah. In terms of the sad puppies,
that's what they're arguing.
But no, well, Flint is saying, but this is not, it's not based on a political thing. It's not based on.
Oh, okay. It's just the state of
mind. In fact, he's pointing out that, you know, there's a great emphasis in the awards, as there are, on short-form fiction, whereas that's almost completely below the radar of mass reading audiences.
Yeah.
And that was just one point he made. But it was a very interesting article which looks at the culture of science fiction and science fiction fandom and how the awards have changed so that back in the 50s and 60s, the authors who were selling lots of books and were known by the wider public – even those who possibly didn't read science fiction, such as, you know, people who might have heard of them, such as Asimov, Heinlein, et cetera, were getting, you know, nominated and winning awards, where now a lot of the people who are getting nominated and winning awards are not those who are well-known outside of the fandom and the writing community to a certain extent. He actually points to Neil Gaiman as one of the rare authors who
– And Terry Pratchett bridges that. Would have
been as well. Well, no, because Terry Pratchett didn't win because he wrote comic fantasy. And that's another point that Eric Flint makes is that, you know, comic SF is, regardless of its ideological bent or lack thereof, is almost never represented on awards ballots. The same as, you know, this is why the Golden Globes have a special categories for comedic works, because it's recognised that we as human beings, even though we love comedy, we love to laugh, don't think it's worthy of awards most often. So that is one of the things you pointed to, is that, yes, Terry Pratchett, who was one of the giants of the field and who sadly recently passed, never won a Hugo Award.
I think he may have knocked one back. I think he may have been nominated. Okay. He got nominated. He got nominated three times or something.
I really shouldn't be saying this stuff without actually checking dozens and dozens of books that he read and how immensely popular he was within fandom. This is what Eric Flint is saying. He's just talking about the divide that he perceives existing between awards culture and fandom, specifically people who go to WorldCon, who are members of ESWA, vote in the Nebulas, and all of in the World Fantasy Award, all of these awards who are he perceives as being becoming quite insular and quite separate from the reading public, so to speak. It's a very thoughtful post. It's a very lengthy post. He provides lots of examples, lots of details.
Should you read the comments?
He makes a very convincing argument. I did not read the comments just because it was a really long post and I got tired by the end of it. I think it was 1 a.m. and I went, I just need to sleep now.
The first few comments were
appreciative. We'll link to it. I'm not sure. Whether that was on Eric's blog or somewhere else. But I will link to it in the show notes because I think it's worth reading because it's not just a rehashing of the Sad Puppies thing. It's a more in-depth look at fandom, the SF community and SF awards and problems that they may have.
I also would like to give a shout out. And I think I've got the name of the blog right, Chaos Horizons, which has been pointed out to me by Jonathan McElmont. It's not by him, it's by some other blog.
I will link to that too.
If I've got the name wrong, I apologise. There's not much we can do about it. I'm not going to come back.
I will give the correct name in the show notes if it is indeed wrong.
But what he does, and I think it's a he, again, I'm not going to correct myself, is an algorithm. He's developing an algorithm that will predict who win the Nebulas and Hugos. They're the two worlds he's focused on.
He does look at nominees shortlists.
Yeah, so he's predicting shortlists, not the winners, but shortlists.
Misunderstood. So he's just predicting a shortlist out of the great pool of anyone who's published.
In a given year, yes.
Wow.
Based on what's – and the algorithm takes into account a lot of different variables. Blog posts that have lots of, notations and numbers and sigmas and alphas and algebraic formulas.
All the Greek alphabet.
Yeah, all that shit. But it's really interesting to read because, again, it takes a mathematical basis to these awards rather than, oh, my God, politics. Not to say, oh, my God, politics doesn't play a role, but I don't know whether his algorithm takes that into account, but he's actually looking for a more dispassionate mathematical view, which is fascinating.
So what's he look like? What are some of the, if you can remember, what are some of the, is it is it like style of writing, content, thematic things?
Based on things like Amazon rankings, Goodread rankings, what has been nominated earlier in the year, what are people talking about?
So he's processing existing reception data. Okay, that's interesting. So he's not...
And then what traditionally these awards have nominated in the past, he takes that into account as well. So he's trawled through...
But the data he's using is reception data. He's not like looking at a book and processing it in terms of your word count, page length, types of words, all that sort of stuff. He's looking at what other people already think about books and, amalgamating all of that into an algorithm, which will, I guess, not having read it, but sounds like it will provide a fairly accurate temperature reading of what people like that year.
He hasn't – I don't think he's been that close though. He's got a couple right.
Okay.
So he's fine-tuning it. He's constantly working on it.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. I will dig that up and link to that in the show notes as well.
And I just wanted to also point out, going back to the Flint book, which I didn't read. Yeah, I was aware of it, but I hadn't read it.
Yeah.
Doesn't he say he's a Trotskyist at some point?
Yes, he does. Yeah. Or possibly former, but definitely socialist.
Okay.
And he points out that he's one of the authors who's – had the most books published with Bain Books, though, the Sad Puppies would have you think that
everyone in Bain. I think it's the other way around. I think it's the Sad Puppies. I think it's people on the other side of the fence who say that everyone who publishes for Bain, other than Lois McMaster Bujold, who somehow gets split apart, is a right-wing person. I don't think it's Sad Puppies arguing that. They're more arguing that Bain gets missed out because it's – and this is the point I was going to make. So there's two elements. It's the popularity. Popular books don't get nominated for Hugo, but also wrong-thinking people don't get nominated. And often the popular people and the wrong thinking people are, according to the sour puppies, are in a very similar category. They overlap.
And I think this is a problem. It's a lot of it is according to the sad puppies. Have you been reading George R. R. Martin's recent
dispatches? I've read quotes, because what Mike Lyer is doing, shout out to File 770 as well,
yes,
is providing snippets from every single source that has mentioned sad puppies in the last 2 months.
Yeah, I actually read through George R. R. Martin's half a dozen posts about this,
because I was from Larry Correa.
I did. I had a bit of the flu earlier this week.
And so that's how you decide to spend your time.
Yes, that is how I decided to spend my time.
Good.
And it's like it's really fascinating, but it does show how easy it is to implement confirmation bias. And that's what human beings do all the time.
Yep.
Because if you start looking at stats and figures and things, it's just not borne out. None of these arguments are borne out. But the other interesting thing that Martin was talking about on his not a blog was that a lot of the language that the slurs and insulting type language that's been attached to the sad / rabid puppies was coined by themselves. So words like wrong think and wrong fan and wrong fun and all of that, they're the ones who made up the word and then said, this is what you guys are calling us. And it's like, no one was before you made that word up. And I think very few people are now, because it's your word and no one wants to touch it. But it's for someone who is really not invested very much in the Hugo Awards, I've spent way too much time in the past week reading about
because it's part of the culture wars that
I think it's quite fascinating.
Moving. And it's now been picked up by a lot of mainstream press. And it's people go, well, who gives a fuck? There's things going on in the world that are far more important than who gets nominated for
Hugo.
You can
say that just about anything except climate change.
You literally can say that about just about anything. I made us start this podcast an hour early just so I could watch
football.
The footy today.
Yeah.
And you got upset with me.
I got up really early.
But I
to
love
get
the
here.
Footy. And if they were doing something similar to the footy, I'd get really upset about
it
and write
would.
Hundreds of blog posts.
Of course you would.
I would.
And I think the problem as other
but
people.
But who cares about the footy? Because, sport, it's irrelevant in when you've got
and I guess
the like, G issue and things.
This kind of things is our sport in a way. So.
Yes.
No, I find it interesting from an outside perspective in that, as I said, I'm not that invested in the Hugo Awards and rarely am eligible to even nominate or vote. But also from an inside perspective within the genres that I love and have read all my life and work in. So it's quite fascinating in kind of a morbid way. And I think the biggest mistake that the sad puppies made was aligning themselves with the rabid
well,
puppy.
Well, they didn't. They're arguing they never did.
Really?
Not, yes.
Their slates were published within 24 hours of each other.
Well, yeah, but they're...
With a very similar logo.
Brad Torgensen and Larry and Larry C have written very long... Well,
I'm sure they have.
They've written very long posts that they are not Vox Day.
I know.
Plus,
that's obvious.
It was quite easy for Vox to get the sad puppy logo and...
In 24 hours.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It just takes me a tinkering.
By the same artist. It was literally the same artist.
Whatever. You're not drawing a conspiracy No, you are. What I think is interesting isn't that it's that they've only started to actively disassociate themselves where people have started pulling out. When Mark Kloose,
yeah,
who was on both, said, I can't be attached to this guy.
Yeah.
When that's happened, now they've gone, well, we're not Vox Day. What they've said is, it was obvious that we weren't that person, and don't think we should have had to have said that. But now that everyone's crying and saying that we need to condemn him, we're going to – and they're not –
And they're not actually condemning him anyway.
No, they're saying, well, we don't do that sort of gulag, although it's hilarious.
Things like, Brad he might be, not a terribly nice person, but
– Yeah, there's a lot of qualifications.
Like he might be.
But only an idiot would think that we were associated in some way, and da-da-da-da-da, and I'm not Vox Day, and I can't explain why Vox Day does what he does, and we're not in contact with Vox Day, and blah-blah-blah-blah-blah. But they're only doing that now because they feel the need. Just like when Mike Lyer asked Larry Correa about the slates early on, saying, hey, you don't seem to be recommending that people actually read these books before they nominate them. Larry C. felt the need to yell at Mike and say, well, obviously I expect people to read the books. But I don't know if that is obvious because you're producing a slate on political grounds. It's not obvious that you want people to actually make their own mind.
You looked at the wording of his original post. It was quite obvious, actually, that the implication was there that you didn't have to read the books. Here's the books. We've already pre-selected them for you based on, you know, our philosophy, our politics, our ultimate goals in putting the slate together. So if you agree with our goals and our philosophy and our, you know, what we'd like to do, here's what you can vote for. That's what a slate is. A slate is not, here's a list of recommendations of books I liked. You might go away and read them and maybe vote for one or two if you like them as well. That's not what a slate is. And they've called it a slate. They're the ones who called it a slate from the beginning.
Because if it was that, if it was go read these recommendations, if you don't like them, don't pick them, you just wouldn't get the same sort of fervor.
No, it was obvious from the very beginning that they were gaming the Hugos, and now that people are calling them on it, some of them are going, well, of course we're gaming the Hugos, what do you expect?
Because
and some of them are going, no, we're not gaming the Hugos, we're really just recommending stuff we like everyone else does. Yeah.
And I think, and I know we were going to talk about this for 3 minutes and it's
only 15. I know. See, it's a cesspool. You just get drawn into
and also it dates this podcast episode. I feel sorry for Elizabeth Jolly, who's not alive, so she won't care, or James, who is alive, because I think, wow, I had to have the sad puppy crap at the front of the podcast that I'm in. But anyway, I think in the last couple of weeks, it's all been about the Vox Dei, burning salt the earth stuff, and also he's a racist and he's this and that. And rightly speaking, Larry Correa and Torgerson have said, well, don't necessarily follow that. We're not necessarily racist. We're not necessarily misogynist, da-da-da. And that's become the argument, whereas really the whole point is what you just said, which is you called it a slate. There's all these issues around slates.
Yeah.
It's going to forget for whatever reason, racist
for whatever reason you drew the slate together, for whatever reason you have, it doesn't matter. It's a left-wing slate, a feminist slate, you game the Hugos.
Yeah, you game the Hugos. And yes, you're now open about that you're gaming the Hugos. Oh, look, we're not log rolling secretly, we're log rolling publicly. But by gaming it, you're then trying to break it. And what Brad Torgerson said recently, I love the Hugos.
They've been fairly successful at it too.
We're not trying to break it. That's Vox who wants to burn and you've broken it. You've fucking broken it.
Yeah.
Live up to the fact what you've done.
Right? Yeah, exactly. You can't. It's like they're, literally, because, and again, I didn't make up the names, but it's like they're pointing to the puppy in the corner going, no, he did it. He broke it all. I was just playing. But the dog came along, the rabid dog, that one. He broke everything. I was just playing.
We were just making innocent points about a conspiracy within Tor to pick right-minded authors. That's all we were doing. Completely innocent. It's this crazy Vox Dei, who, by the way, he's a Visigoth, but we sort of half love him, who brought in all the race card stuff.
Even a stop clock is right twice a day, blah, blah, blah. You know what you do with a clock that's only right twice a day?
Throw it out.
You throw it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Should we do the book?
Get a new clock.
Sure.
We should. I should not even have brought that.
See, the problem is, can I just say this to the listeners? In the talking points, I want to read this, quote unquote. Do we want to talk about sad puppies, and whether they have a point, mention Eric Flint's analysis if we do. We didn't actually talk about that before we started the podcast, so I just went straight into it. And
yes, it was they see the question marks, as in I suspected you might have wanted to talk about it, and the question marks was me kind of going, we have to.
Fortunately, you put little times in the show notes, so people can literally just skip all this shit.
Yes, and I will put notes, time codes for people to skip if they want to and probably should.
But thank you, Ori, for his house. Which is how we
for the people
this.
Who skipped ahead.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. All right, so we're going to begin with The Well by Australian. Well, these are two Australian books. They're by
they
Australian
are.
Author Elizabeth Jolly.
Right.
Which
aiming to increase our Australian quotient this year.
Which you recommend.
Doing that up front and out loud.
Where's your, can I see your copy of The Well?
I borrowed it from my university library because I'm a poor, struggling student now and can't afford books.
I got mine off Advanced Book Exchange, and it's got the motion picture.
I know, it's
it,
pretty, it's an ugly
which
cover.
Which I think that's Miranda Otto, I think.
Yeah, it's not a very good cover.
Is it? Have you seen the film?
I saw the film when it first came out, but it was like late 90s or something, so I remembered almost nothing about the film except that I think I saw it. I may even be misremembering that I saw it because unless it's very different from the book, yeah, I don't remember the stuff happening in the book.
I am half fascinated, but it's not exactly a film that's made an impression on Australian.
It's hard to find, actually, because I last week I tried to – only last week, so I had to get a copy quickly, and it was like – it's just really not around.
It came and went.
Yeah, yeah, I don't – I think it has been released on DVD, but it's not that –
it's one of Miranda Otto's first roles, isn't
it? Yeah, she would have been quite young there in – because 95 or 96, yeah, something correct. Like that. She would have been quite young.
So it's a very ugly cover.
It is not a good cover.
It is really ugly. If you get
Penguin, well, shame on you.
Will we put that in the show notes, the cover of The Well?
I found a nicer cover for the show notes, okay, that I'm going to use.
Well, it's your book. You want to...
Oh, it's my book.
Well, you chose
technically, it. It's my friend Michelle's book because she recommended it to me. And I realized, actually, that I thought I'd read Elizabeth Jolly before, but I hadn't, because the book that I thought... The book that I had read that I thought was an Elizabeth Jolly book was not.
Who was it?
It was Tiralira by the River, and the author is Jessica Anderson. So for all these years, I was carrying around in my head, oh, yeah, Elizabeth Jolly, she wrote that book I really liked in it. So I'm sorry, Jessica Anderson. But so this was, in fact, the first Elizabeth Jolly book I had read, and I loved it. I loved it so much. I've got to go and find her others now. This actually was the Miles Franklin winner. For the year it was published as well.
I'll tell you someone who didn't love it.
Did you go? You didn't go to Goodreads, did you?
No, my
okay.
wife.
Okay. Oh, your wife.
So.
When did she read it?
In year 12.
Ah.
For year 12.
Ah.
And
yeah,
she hated every page.
Yeah, I think we do a great disservice to a lot of good books by making 17-year-olds read them under exam pressured conditions.
Yeah, it's not fair, is it?
I had to read the poet Seamus Heaney for my year 12, and I hated them. I hated those poems so much. They were awful. They were stupid. I hated them. And then a couple years later, I was in uni, and I was just throwing stuff out, and I came across those poems and my notes and everything, and I was like, oh, these stupid poems, let me read them again because they're stupid. And I just fell in love with them. And now he's one of my favourite poets.
See, I don't think that was the reaction. I don't think Jules suddenly looked at The Well and said, yeah, why don't I give that
Well, she hadn't
go?
Read it again.
Well, no, but so. She didn't feel the – she wanted me to take it out of the house.
Yeah,
she didn't want the book in the house. She wanted to be in the same room while I was reading the book.
That's terrible.
And so, of course, I taunted her by telling her where I was at. Inopportune
times. Oh, the trauma.
They've just run over someone.
So Jules,
she's now stuck in The Well.
So Jules will not want to be listening to this podcast.
No, I'm going to force her.
I'm sorry, Jules.
Because she kept saying to me that when at school, it was always to dig deeper into the symbolic and metaphoric meaning
yes.
of this novel, which, you know, it's there, I suppose. But
so The Well, vaginas.
Oh, that's right. The dry well.
The obvious psychoanalytic reading.
Yeah. But is it though? Because...
Oh, it's the obvious psychoanalytic reading,
two
yes.
things popped into my head when I'm reading this. Yeah. And the same, obviously, two things that popped into your head, which was Shirley Jackson and vaginas. They're the two things that went straight to my head.
That's not a sentence I ever thought I'd heard
you
say.
It's just that you've got this main character who's obviously, well, sexless to a degree.
And this
constant description of a dry well and how dry it is.
It's not a constant description.
It's described. And then, of course, it ends with the flooding of the well
yes.
and a sort of orgasmic element to the climax of the novel.
The grin on your face.
Seriously, no, no. I did not read anything around this book. Okay?
Yeah, no.
It just seemed to me am I wrong?
No, no, no. I think it's an extremely valid reading. I think it's, you know, I mean, it's a reading of it. And, yeah, look, I mean, Elizabeth Jolly's writing this in the 1980s. Jung and Freud are not going to be unknown to her. I'm sure she's aware, exactly aware of what the motifs and their associative connotations are. So this is not what's really interesting is that we're living in a world where there is a lot of critical analysis of texts in our culture and a lot of critical theory and across various, you know, disciplines and ways of thinking about the world and what we produce in it. And you could argue that when this was all beginning, the era of critical theory and literary discourse, these were things that were teased out of books and existing product, existing cultural artifacts, and meaning was dug out and blah, blah, blah. And you could say, oh, but the author wouldn't have even known about that. Now it's like, we know this, like people writing, we're aware of Freudian connotations and Jungian archetypes and all of this stuff. It's this interesting meshing between critical theory and the literature it studies and theorizes around, and the people who make it, who a lot of us are very aware of this critical theory. So we're no longer writing books and making movies and so on, you know, completely blind and deaf to.
They're actually tools that we use.
Yeah, they're tools that we use. They're things that we interact with. And likewise, then the critics interact with those again. So it's this very enmeshed thing. So I don't think, A, it's by any means a long bow to draw to talk about, the psychological readings of The Well. At the same time, I don't think it's anything that would have been absent from Elizabeth Jolly's mind when she was writing The Well. So it's an interesting symbiosis that
we haven't really described what The Well's about.
Yes, so The Well is about an older woman, Hester, and her young friend,
Ingenue.
Well, she was an orphan.
Who adopts?
Who took in that? Well, she didn't ever formally adopt her, but she was just taken into her household at the time Hester's father was alive, and Catherine or Kathy, which again you kind of think Kathy, like there's a very famous Kathy in Gothic, female Gothic literature.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Catherine Hepburn, but
No Wuthering Heights, oh. Which is also set, you know, on a broken down farm in an isolated community.
And there's a storm.
There is definitely a storm. That's a very famous storm.
I read Wuthering Heights when I was at school and I detested it. Yay!
So, I mean, that's like, that could be a longbow. But, you know.
There's no Heathcliff, though.
No, there's no Heathcliff. But unless you there call is that a old Hester. Codger. But there is a Hester.
Is it? In Wuthering Heights?
No, in the
Oh, you're saying Heathcliff could be Hester? That's odd.
No, I'm not saying that. But, yeah, so you have Hester who has. Taken in Kathy to be a household helper in some respect, but who quickly becomes a friend, a child figure, and also a substitute lover or an imagined lover.
Yes, and that's where I found it to be oddly uncomfortable.
I think it's very uncomfortable. I think the book trades in discomfort all the way through. And they're on a remote farming area, and the book traces Hester's decline in material wealth, social status, and so on, and draws her and Kathy into this closeted, you know, claustrophobic. Any other C words you want to throw in there? Little partnership. And they hit a man in a car and throw him down a well.
Yeah, it should be pointed out that Hester, not entirely sensibly, when she sells her farm, she takes a good chunk of the money and hides it in her house.
Yes.
In the little house that they
this
keep.
This is how she has her money, because it's how her father used to keep a lot of his money.
Well, she's warned not to do that, though.
Of course, yes.
So what happens?
All her money. Like, a lot of her money is very well invested and so on, but she does keep a sizable amount of cash in a hat on a shelf in the kitchen.
Which then gets stolen, but they just so happen to hit the guy who's stolen the money.
Maybe. See, what's so fascinating about the
I suppose
well,
it's never proven because,
what is so
because he's already in the bottom of the well. Exactly.
this is what I – one of the things that I loved about the book is that I cannot make up my mind. And in fact, I think I'm just going to keep them both in my head, Kathy's story and Hester's story, because I don't know which one's true.
What? Whether he's alive at the bottom of the well?
I don't know.
No, she's
I
mad.
I don't know.
Kathy's mad.
Where'd the $100 come from?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know.
Or did she steal the money? But her reaction to the missing money seemed really genuine. But she really loves movies and acting. Like, you don't know. There's so much, like, that whole scene, because at the end, after
It could be a desperate guy trying to
Exactly.
Who's, yeah.
Or maybe he's alive and moaning about something, and Kathy's making up all this shit.
And Hester is
sick. But you don't know. Hester's got this awful migraine, which she gets from time to time, which kind of lays her up in bed for 3 days, like my poor mother gets occasionally.
And so does my mum, actually.
Definitely lays you out for three days. And so at this moment when she's come, because they realise that the man that Kathy hit, Kathy was driving the car home late at night after a dance and hit someone, and Hester's idea was just to throw it down the well and never mind about it. But then they discovered the money was gone, put two and two together, and this man had stolen from another farm as well. So then there's Hester needing to go into town and get a rope so that Kathy can climb down and get the money.
The rope getting part of the novel is hilarious.
It is.
She goes into the shop.
All those bits in town, every time she's interacting with people.
Yeah. The shopkeeper, the shopkeeper's husband, there's a reverend at one point.
There's the poet lady.
Oh, the poet lady,
The square bucket for her feet, who I think at the end Hester is angling for her to become Kathy's replacement.
Oh, that's
how I read that ending. Because that last paragraph is about her looking forward to seeing the lady who wanted the square foot bucket. It's a really dense book. We were saying that whole scene where Hester's in bed with the migraine and Kathy keeps coming in and saying, oh, he said he wants to marry me now. Oh, he said he's so glad I'm 21 because if I was 18, he might have to get permission. And he wants to have three children and two boys and them for like, and she, so she keeps running in with all this information, which Hester and I think us, at least at the beginning, are thinking, oh gosh, she's flipped out because she killed someone and she's imagining all, and poor Hester, who is vomiting and in pain, it just keeps on saying, go away, Kathy. Go. I'll get up in an hour, Kathy. I'll get up at 4 o'clock, Kathy. And Kathy's saying, you have to get up. Where's the rope? And that whole scene, like, I kept switching back and forth. Like, at the beginning, it was like, oh, yes, Kathy's deranged. And then it was like, she's really detailed and also crafty with what she's asking about too, about the rope and the car. And like, she's obviously tried to find the rope and couldn't find it. And it must be in the car. And where are the keys? And then she brings the money back. I'm thinking, fuck, the guy's really alive. but I don't know. Did Kathy take the money in the first place?
Steve,
like Mr. Bird said. Yeah. And so she's, and as Hester at one point surmises, is Kathy now bringing out this $100 from wherever she hid it to try and prove her story that the guy, like I, and then at the end when Hester goes out, where she finally is well enough to get up and she goes out and she thinks she hears a voice, but she's not sure, and the storm and the rain, and she sees the body in the well and she thinks it was holding on to the rail of the ladder now that the water's floated him up high enough, but she doesn't, like, I don't know. I finished this book. I went back and read that bit. I don't know.
What?
And I love that. I love that both accounts can, they seem to exist comfortably in my head. And it's this, it's like, it's a delusion. I have a delusion that both these accounts can coexist.
You
because
read
they
about,
can't.
You
the
read
guy's
about
either
the
dead or the guy is not dead.
You read
and
a,
yet.
You read about the book.
Mm. I read about the book.
Well, you read reviews, did you not?
Oh, no, I didn't actually find a lot about, because it's an old book. It was pre-internet.
So what?
It was No, it's serious argument. It was pre-internet, this book. It was 1985.
Yeah.
And so there was nothing on the internet. And things.
No, seriously, are you kidding me? Is this even on Goodreads?
Yes, it's on Goodreads. Oh, I don't.
Okay,
I don't just, play
or Amazon
Goodreads.
Or whatever.
It's there. But what I'm saying is we don't have the wealth of criticism that books which are released now and in the last 10 years have on the internet, and stuff which was published obviously at the time was in newspapers and things like that, which haven't necessarily been archived online. So it's harder to find the discourse around books that are published pre-1990 simply because of that.
So really,
I'm not saying, no, I'm sure it's out there. What I'm saying is me yesterday, Google search, not digging up.
You're basically saying that this podcast will be about the most recent.
No, well, I. Well, the most recent,
yeah,
sure,
obviously.
But
yeah, one of the most.
I mean, there are a lot of academic articles which reference the well, but I didn't really feel like reading more 30-page papers about a book which isn't for my PhD.
Okay.
So I put them aside. I was trying to find, as I do with most of the books
delusion,
we read,
the delusional
the
experience
of it.
The delusional experience you had, I actually didn't.
So what? So you think he's just dead?
Far too literal sometimes.
And you think Kathy took the money? Because he has to, right? There's $100.
Well, no, no.
She either took all the money or she's siphoned bits off and she's got that.
It was more that. It was more
Hester
that she
has got such control of her house, and it's only like the place, the little shearer's shack that they moved into after she sold her big house to the Bordens. It's tiny. I mean, it's described. It's so tiny. There's nowhere to hide anything. And Hester cleans all the time, and she's in, and she supervises Kathy's cleaning. She's in such control over that place. I can't imagine. Kathy's got a hidey hole that she could just keep money she's been stealing. And she's certainly not spending anything because Kester knows exactly what's
bought. But Kathy is, as you said, crafty. And that's the thing
she
that
is.
I got out of
I know.
It. So she might have found
the
place.
She might have, yeah.
And I still think, though, that the man probably did have the chunk of the cash and he is down there. I went with a literalist interpretation of it because what I was interested in wasn't necessarily – about the Schrodinger cat sort of scenario.
But, yes.
But
Schrodinger as well.
But more the relationship between the two women. And I just found it to be extremely uncomfortable because it's not like Kathy is not – it's Kathy, isn't it?
Kathy, yeah.
It's not like she's not of age. She's a 14-year-old girl.
No, she was 16 when she came to work.
So she
essentially when she came to work for Hester
and
her
father. Yeah, but over that, she's 21.
I think the reference at the end – because I was wondering like all the way like how old must Kathy be now because the book talks about years passing and she still acts like – a 16-year-old.
Correct.
That's
Hester
what is keeping her.
Me and maybe come. Yeah. She's stunted. This is stunted.
And so, but
crafty, but stunted.
But how much of that? And this is what I'm wondering about the guy. Like, how much of that is an act? Because she is very crafty, and you get glimpses of those things where you go, "Oh, she is. Oh, she is so obviously manipulating Hester, and Hester can't even see that." Like, it's so interesting, both their characters, because the book is written from neither. Well, it's primarily Hester's viewpoint, but it's not necessarily her point of view.
But why does she stay with Hester? That didn't become clear to me because it can't be for the money entirely.
Well, that might be part of it. Part of it
but
is...
But that wouldn't have been in the scene until late because she did...
No, but she's always had... Like Hester is well. Hester comes from a wealthy landed family, and it's only in the course of this book that her father dies and she has to sell the land.
And there is this whole thing also that the friend of hers from the orphanage is coming to, to visit.
Joanna, who's coming to visit,
that's right.
Which is this threat which hangs over the whole book.
And who gets realised?
And she never arrives.
Never arrives.
Like the book ends on the day that they're going to pick Joanna up.
Yeah.
And like it doesn't end like Joanna's coming. They're going to pick her up. Hester ran out of petrol. She's going to get petrol. Then they're going to go back to the car and they're going to pick – I mean, she's coming. And I think Elizabeth Jolly has the – like part of the humour of this book and part of the reason why, I say that Elizabeth Jolly is evidently aware of a lot of the critical discourse around writing a book like The Well because she's got that character who is the same, who is the poet woman and the foot bath woman and the woman who Kathy begins to feel a bit attracted to at the very end, who talks about, she's writing a novella and there are all these critical expectations of how it needs to be and what she needs is this intruder. And this is like
wasn't that just Elizabeth Jolly's Hitchcock moment?
But she undermines that. Like she's talking about how you expect a book to be.
Yeah, okay, yep.
And then she doesn't – that's exactly – she's just saying, yes, I know what you expect. This is not the book I'm writing. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful little – like in itself it's funny. It's just a funny little scene in itself because she's a bit of a – she comes off as a slightly kind of pretentious move to the country – city woman who's going to move to the country and buy a farmlet and write poetry and write a novel and blah, blah, blah. Of course, by the time you get to the end of the book, you remember that scene. You go, she was telling me all along, Joanna will never arrive because that would be trite and that would be expected. And it's not a letdown.
I actually thought Joanna would appear halfway through the novel and it would become...
The whole novel you're expecting Joanna to appear when it is set up that early on. I have a friend who from the orphanage and we're growing up now.
And she's a bit of a wild girl.
And Hester's afraid that she'll come and she'll take Kathy away. And you're expecting that for the entire novel.
And
then it takes
this good
left
Christian girl.
Turn with the... And the thing is, the novel opens with a preface about... The hitting the guy.
Yeah, did you not find that was bizarre as well?
So that's
and it repeats that seemingly word for word
word,
but makes some very important
little
changes.
It does, and so you've got that right from the beginning. Yeah. And really, really, that should be what you're thinking about the whole book. But instead, Elizabeth Jolly very cleverly has got this puppet on her hand going, look, Joanna, think about Joanna. Because really the entire book is not about Joanna, this friend coming to, you know, provide a wedge in the relationship between Hester and Kathy. It's about the man in the well and what that does to their relationship and how Hester can never trust Kathy now because Hester doesn't know. Hester doesn't know if the man was alive. Hester doesn't know if Kathy took the money. So she's already distancing herself from Kathy at the end of the book. And I loved the doubling that went throughout this whole book.
Because you love doubling?
Yeah.
This is not the first book we've reviewed where doubling has occurred.
Yeah, no, I do. I do love doubling motifs. They're a very powerful way to hold two things against each other and look at them at different angles. And in The Well, you've got the Hester-Kathy relationship, which is an inverted mirror of the relationship that Hester had with her German nanny growing up.
Yes, and that's referenced
And Hester's trying to recreate this because Hester was infatuated with her German nanny, possibly a childish form of love for her nanny, and assumed that this was reciprocal. And when you look at it from the outside, yes, I'm sure the nanny very much did care for the little girl, but she was actually in love with Hester's father and, in fact, was pregnant by him and then had a miscarriage, it seemed.
And there's blood everywhere.
And then was quickly ushered out of the child's – or everyone's life was dismissed, effectively. And now I'm beginning to wonder because I was thinking about it, having read the bit at the end where, as I said, I'm sitting with this dual illusion of what's happened. I'm like, when did Hester was supposed to go to Europe with her nanny? Do you actually really thinking about that? Do you think that happened or do you think that's more of Hester's fantasy? Because I actually don't see.
You don't trust anything in this book.
Not now, because this is what, like, but in a good way. It's not that, like, the book is impenetrable or inconsistent. Like, it's the way the book is setting up the psychology of these two women and doing it so well. Because now I doubt, like, when I think about it, I step out again. Hester's had me in her world, in her house, and I just believe everything she said because she's so good.
We should say that if you haven't read the book, one of the things is that they're going to use the money from the sale to go to Europe.
To a trip.
Again, to mirror
Hester
what,
will take Kathy to Europe just as Hildy took Hester. But now I'm thinking, when and how did that happen? Do you actually see Hester's father
packing off?
Well, he's not an asshole.
He was a grumpy old man.
He was a working farming man who had no sons to help him and had a daughter who was born.
You're so nice.
With the deformity of the leg so that she couldn't do a lot of physical work on the farm either.
Yep, okay.
But when do you see that happening? Do you actually see him packing off his lover, now we know, not just Hester's nanny and general housekeeper, but his lover off to Europe with his daughter?
No.
And do you see his mother, Hester's grandmother, who had really had it in for the nanny, and now we know why, also letting them go off on this continental jaunt to Europe?
It doesn't make sense.
With the boiled eggs served in the glasses. Yeah. And it doesn't make sense, does it?
No.
And as soon as you step out of Hester's world and her house where everything is just so claustrophobic, you can go, wait, hang on, wait, what? Like, the spell this book weaves is amazing. Like you said, you take everything literally. I think that's what the book is making you do. Like, you believe what this book is telling you. And it's only often in retrospect that you're going, hang on a second, trip to Europe, boiled eggs in glasses, what? So, yeah, I think Hester's a lot more delusional in a very deep and real sense than the voice of the book would initially have us believe.
And what about the Shirley Jackson connection?
I don't think it's a connection. It did remind me of We Have Always Lived in the Castle because you have this same interiority of the self in it.
Well, but it felt like an Australian version. It felt like...
Yeah, I do know...
Just that they're not sisters. That's really the main difference.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the relationship is really different. I mean, in We Have Always Lived in the Castle, you have the younger partner in the relationship being the one who is very manipulative and oppressive of the oldest. She is.
Yeah.
Mary Cat is the reason why her sister stays in the house and does not have a life.
Because she killed the family.
Yes, right? But Mary Cat is the one.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas in The Well, it's Hester who has the younger girl and is responsible for keeping her.
Okay, so it inverts it, but there's still a tragedy that's, someone dies.
Yeah.
Killed by the younger person.
Yeah. But in Shirley Jackson, it's a very orchestrated murder for very good reasons. I mean, Cousin Charlie comes in and really tries to demolish their life, whereas in the world, it is literally an accident, which is then tried to be covered up. And then there's a spillover effect from having covered it up, right? So, but it's got, I mean, look, they're both gothic family romances. That's what they are in an isolated world, which is part of the gothic, the isolation, the sense of confinement. And especially in the female gothic. I mean, that's why they're similar, because they're using the same toolkit. They're using the same sensibilities. I don't think they're anywhere near the same book.
You don't have a big pitchforking.
No, they're really different. They're really different books, but they're operating in the same. They're operating in the same generic space.
Yes. All right. Well, that's why I got that feeling. Yeah. You're right. Plot wise, they're not the same. Yeah. I agree.
And a lot of the similarities.
I felt this was a riff, that there was a definite vibe.
Yeah.
I
don't know. Maybe Elizabeth Jolly did read We've All Lived in the Castle and thought, oh, I could do a take on this. Or maybe she'd never read any Shirley Jackson at all. But
the vibe was so strong in me.
Yeah, but what
like
I'm saying.
Force.
Yeah, sure, because you've read the Shirley Jackson book. But what I'm saying is they've got all these similarities because they're working with the same toolkit, so to speak. So the isolation, that's a staple of gothic fiction. The confinement within a domestic space, a staple of female gothic
fiction.
What
about the class element?
The class element also runs through gothic fiction.
Because in this, Hester starts because they're landed folk, as you said. They're higher class. But when the moment she starts selling to the Bordens, no one takes her, you know, no one treats her.
No, because she no longer is a landowner.
Correct.
Or a farm owner. The Bordens are now in her house and have her farm and have her status.
Which is what, and therefore and her, becomes more important as
her
a result.
Her status was always tenuous too. Her status was not just linked to the fact that her family owned the farm and the land. Oh, sorry, it was only linked to the fact that her family, like she had no status within herself as Hester, mostly because of her gender and her physical disability.
But the point is made that if she would go to the stores, they would treat her with great respect.
Oh, yes.
It didn't matter whether she was disabled or a woman. It was just...
Because she was the landowner.
Yeah.
But in the same way that I don't think if Hester's father, while he was still living, had to sell his land and his house to the Bordens,
he would have been downgraded in the same way.
His status would have been as diminished. I don't think so. I think he would have still been given a fairly high status in the community, whereas Hester is immediately brushed aside because that was her status. That was her only status. Now she's just an old crippled woman.
Yeah.
With a weird relationship to that girl who she never lets leave her side.
Kirsten, can you please provide a one-line summary of the world? Yes, it's about the old crippled woman who has a weird relationship with that girl.
Yeah, but I think there's it's a book that I want to read again, and I think it's going to be one of these books like Shirley Jackson's novels that I do come back to every few years and read again.
And you're right, there's a density to the writing, but
so
not
so much to tease out.
There's a density to the writing, but it's not dull or overwritten or purple. It's just this. It's every word has been I've said this before, but every word has been chosen.
It has.
Great, deliberate.
I was just thinking on the way here, just on the train this morning, and I was thinking about, what I was wanted to talk about. And it struck me that even the name, like Mr. Bird, who is Hester's father's friend.
Accountant, helper.
Friend and accountant and helped him and now helps Hilda manage her finances.
And sort of wants a bit of, you mean Hester?
Hester. What did
you
I say?
Hilda.
Sorry. And now helps.
And possibly wants a bit of Hester.
Oh, no, because I was thinking about that.
Come on. No.
I think
her delusion that she's transposed onto him, even.
I think Hester is paranoid about everybody.
Okay.
I think when you get to the end and you see what he's done with the, because he has a coronary.
Yeah,
he
does.
Or a stroke.
He does.
And he dies at the end off stage. And Hester is given all his very careful, meticulous notes about exactly what he's done with her investments and when they should mature and when, all of this sort of stuff. And she's quite taken aback by the level of care shown for her. And Mr. Bird was the family accountant and friend and to some extent, I gather, business manager since she was born.
Yeah,
I don't think the naming of him as Bird is accidental. And I think of him as he is actually the mother. He's the mother bird. He's the mother bird who could never push Hester out of the nest. So she's never been able to actually be fully independent. She is still really childlike.
I got this weird vibe. Again, I got this vibe that he wanted a piece.
No, but he's never been like that. Like there's nothing he's ever said or done or anything.
I wish I'd marked a spot in the book.
Elizabeth, I think Hester gets disgruntled a lot and she thinks, oh, he's just angling for the farm or whatever. But I really don't think so. I think he has become this maternal figure, and I think that's evidenced by the choice of his name. And the fact that Hester is herself, when you step back, she's not competent. She isn't. She doesn't know what to do with money. She doesn't know actually how to, even though she knows a lot about cows and you know, a lot of facts about farming and how to pick good livestock and all of that sort of stuff, she couldn't actually run the farm and doesn't want to and doesn't really know how to take care of her money. She's in some ways as closeted and naive as she keeps Kathy, which is another. But I think, like Mr. Bird, I think there's this genuine parental affection he has for Hester. And I don't get, like, you talk about the level of creepiness between Hester and Kathy's relationship, which I agree is, no, it's creepy.
No. I mean, with Mr. Bird.
But with Mr. Bird, I don't get that at all.
I definitely got the paternalistic element.
Yeah.
And he's always trying to help, and he's trying to, and he's saying, look, you better watch out. This Kathy girl, I don't trust
and
her.
And he never makes any advances to her.
No, he doesn't.
He never says anything that's even ambiguous. Yeah, again, we're in Hester's head this book.
Yeah, you're right.
And you step outside and as she realises at the end, it's like, wow, he was just a really, really nice guy who loved her like a daughter and was trying to take care of her up until the very end, or his very end.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice portrayal in a book like this, because it would have been very easy to cast him in a Cousin Charlie type of a role where he either had designs on Hester or Kathy. And thinking about it now, like as, again, on second reading, maybe I might pick something up, but thinking about it, I don't see that anywhere.
I did mark some spots, but there's nothing that jumps out, so I apologise.
Yeah, that's okay.
But look, there is there is, though, a general ickiness about this novel.
There is.
And I haven't said it, but I really loved it too.
Yeah.
I just you have found a level of a depth to it that never struck me, because I wasn't reading it from, as I said, I didn't see the delusional side. I saw Kathy being someone. I read the literal, I'm sorry, I was literalist. Kathy's killed someone, she's flipped, Hester's half stuffed in the brain anyway, but a completely different sort of madness. There's madness going on throughout the novel, but they're different varieties.
Yeah.
And that's what I found fascinating.
And then
this relationship between the two that shouldn't work in any way, shape or form, but sort of does. Because, I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, is this even a successful relationship between the two? I mean, we know what Hester feels for Kathy.
Yeah, it's not. I think it's a really manipulative relationship.
Kathy just leave. But there must be something keeping her there. Well, I know she doesn't have a job. I get that.
Yeah.
But there is comments made, especially when there's they sell the property and they have this party and Kathy's mingling with boys and that. And there's this sort of general view that she could find a nice boy and go, you know, sort of deal.
I think there is a mutual, if at times perverse, affection from both sides, not just from Hester's side of it. And I think Jolly did a really clever thing by bringing Kathy into the story, into Hester's life at the age of 16. If she'd come in any younger, I think the inappropriateness and the creepiness factor of that relationship would have been overwhelming.
Yeah, it would have been
At this point,
it's just uncomfortable. It's not like,
and she's not like Catherine dresses her and thinks of her as a very childlike, naive girl.
Well, Hester treats her like a doll. Treats her like a doll, and she buys her clothes. It's all about.
But they also make clothes together, and they have their like. Because my first thing was, oh yeah, she's like, this is Hester's doll, but actually she's not. Like she's very. She's often struck. In fact, in that tiny scene that I had to read twice to make sure I was reading it right, where she remembers Kathy dancing and then she has to pull over by the side of the road and have a wank. like Kathy's independence and her, the way she manifests independent thought and action is actually part of the reason Hester likes her.
Yeah.
Like her diamondism and her...
Why did you have to read the scene twice?
Because it's really subtle. So I've just... I'll read you what she's written. So she's driving to town to get the rope.
Yeah.
So she's on her own, which is the first time she's gone anywhere without Kathy for the entire book, because they usually go everywhere together. And she's thinking about Kathy dancing at the party the night before. She remembered Catherine's animated movements and the ripple of the light yellow dress. She groaned. The dance was for her the only manifestation of physical love. Hester did not feel guilty about the feeling. It was private. She pulled off onto the gravel for a few precious minutes alone on the edge of the great emptiness.
And you read that as she's...
Well, then she says, afterwards, in her weakness, she cried a little and remembered again all too quickly. Yes, she pulled off for a wank. She'd remembered Kathy dancing and gone, oh, that's really hot. I need to pull the Toyota to the side of the road. But as she says, like, that's her private thing. She doesn't even impose that on Catherine. Catherine, of course, knows Hester feels like that. And Hester knows that Kathy knows Hester feels like that, because there's that scene when she's imagining one of the letters to and from Joanna where she's thinking, oh, I wonder if Kathy writes about me and my and Hildy, and when it wasn't like that at all. So it's this layering of this, the sort of theory of mind stuff, right? I know that you know that I know that you know that I know that. And this book does this all
it's
the way
tricksy.
Through.
It's tricksy.
So I do want to read it again, because I want to tease out a little bit more where Hester's delusions are and where they're clearly not, and map where they go to her relationship with Kathy and her relationship as she perceived it with Hildy.
Well, before you read
it. It's a fascinating book. I loved it so much. So thank you to my friend Michelle for recommending it.
And thank you to Michelle from me as well, because I enjoyed it as well.
Mm.
Not thank you from Julie. before you go and read The Well again, I think we should go on and review James Bradley's Clay.
Before we do... One last thing. One of the things I did find on the interwebs, because it was only from 2007 when Elizabeth Jolly died, was her obituary in the New York Times. And I will point out, the first paragraph says, Elizabeth Jolly, an Australian writer who came to wide public attention only late in life, but whose distinctive literary voice and eccentric literary preoccupations eventually made her one of the country's most acclaimed novelists, died in Perth on February the 13th. She was 83. And then we have a bit about a reported illness, four whole paragraphs about her writing, and even a quote from one of her novels, her prize winning. And it's not until paragraph 8 that the fact that she was married even comes
up. Isn't that lovely?
Yeah.
And there's no comment about her
husband, Leonard Jolly,
multiple men, and
did actually establish the library at the University of Western Australia. So he was a figure in his own right. But, you know, we get seven whole pages of Elizabeth Jolly and her work.
And not her sexual endeavours.
Wow. Or her marital status or physical attractiveness. So thank you, New York Times. Thank you for writing a lovely obituary for one of my new most beloved authors.
It was New York Times?
New York Times.
Oh, there you go. All right, so James Bradley.
Yes, now we'll move on.
Go from an obituary to James Bradley.
Yes.
James, may you live a long life. So.
Oh! I'm sorry, James. Well, you can't fix this. Continue.
Well, you could fix it.
No, I will not fix it.
Okay.
Go.
Clade.
If he dies, it's your fault.
Shut up. Clade is the book I chose.
Yes.
Another Australian author. It's a science fiction novel.
It's Cli-Fi.
It's what?
Don't look at me like that.
It's Clive-by.
Cli-Fi.
Cli-Fi.
Oh, you've heard of Cli-Fi.
No.
It's the word.
Climate
change fiction. Cli-Fi.
They're bullshit, that's a term.
That's not a term. You can Google it in academic databases and everything.
Just academic call it databases. What it is, which is slow apocalypse fiction.
Because that was the name of a novel.
Slow apocalypse? Yeah, but
so
still,
this is
that's
a broader term. Cli-Fi. Because slow apocalypse also could be other things.
Yeah, I know that.
Well,
but
this
is a climate change version of the slow apocalypse.
Yeah, which fits into the Cli-Fi genre. You've lost this already. I did not make up the word.
That is just terrible. Essentially.
But I do like it.
Climate change is wreaking its vengeance on the planet Earth as a result of the things we've done.
I don't think we should use value judgments.
Humans? Would you like to describe the novel?
No, I'm just saying climate change is not vengeful. It is just what's happening, mostly because of what we've done.
Okay, we...
not you and me. Well, although, you know, I... did leave my computer on over last night downloading something, so that probably didn't help.
And I don't, and I drive a car.
Two cars, actually. Two car family. I rode my bike to the shops on the weekend.
What?
I rode my bike. I'm just saying, you know.
Thank you. Okay, so this is now become a discussion on a carbon footprint, not on the actual
apart from what I actually exhaled riding my bike, that was a good day.
Adam, the book starts off with Adam. Interestingly, that it starts off with a character named Adam.
You can say interesting. I'm going to say, especially when it's partnered with Noah, who survives the flood later, a bit twee.
Sorry. I like that, though.
It's a bit twee. Right. If it had just been Adam, we'd let that go.
Well, no, because it's the whole point that he's the
first. Yeah, I know. I know. He is literally the first man. And literally the
he's not the
top
man.
Of the clade that is this novel.
Correct. That's right. But he's not the first man.
He's the first man. He's literally the first man we meet. Like, yeah. He's but in the first
not,
sentence.
Well, it's not, I think Adam also is, and not just because he's the top of the clade, but because he's also the guy who is beginning to discover through his time in Antarctica or wherever he is that we're fucked.
Well, he's part of a big team.
A bigger team. Yes, correct. Yeah, all right.
Sorry. I just like when your referential names work, they work really well. In this case, the Adam Noah thing, especially with the flood. Oh God, no, sorry, not for me.
Yeah, but the biblical. That was one of the things that resonated, the biblical element to this.
Okay, not for me.
And now I'm whining. Again, I've started Bible? Whining. Whatever. Anyway.
Adam, it's a small point.
This is the story of Adam and Ellie and their family, essentially, through the decline of and possible hopeful rise of the human species. Depending,
or maybe just hopeful stumbling along for a bit longer. Yeah,
the book doesn't end with everyone dead. That's not what happens.
No.
What happens is, which I think is actually more a realistic way of thinking it, is that yes, there's massive flooding, there's massive change to climate, parts of London vanish or England vanish, things vanish, but we survive, we adapt, technology still, it's not like we all just go back to caveman times,
mm-hmm.
Technology progresses,
yep.
And it's just there's less people on the planet and there's more chance of an outbreak of things like a disease that will kill people. So yes, the death toll is much higher. The landmass we live on is much smaller.
Yes.
The weather patterns are less predictable.
And more savage.
But one thing I found really interesting is that the young kids later on in the novel, because what this book does is essentially skip many years. It's not set during a 5-week period.
We should say from the outset that it's essentially a collection of short stories,
yes,
that are strung along a linear timeline.
Yes.
And so each story will skip ahead. And I think the skipping ahead is a bit longer each time.
Yeah.
I'm not
possibly,
sure. I didn't
yeah.
go back and try to map that accurately.
And it's not generational skips. We're talking only if you
No,
four
it
or five
spans
years.
Adam's adult life.
But yes, correct. It spans.
In the last story, he spoilers, dies. He's dead.
Yes. so, we're talking 30 or 40, 50 years, whatever. In that sort of quantum.
Yeah.
And at that end, when there are teenagers, so we end with is it Noah's daughter?
It's the daughter of the woman who was the girl who looked after Noah when he was a boy.
Yep.
The Chinese girl whose mother died.
That's
in the
right.
pandemic.
Sorry. Yep. I apologize.
So it's not just like Adam's direct biological family, for want of another word. It's also people who come into his familial
which is
line.
Still a clade.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, but I'm just pointing out it's not so insular. It does.
But if you look at that young girl, she's still having fun with her friends. They go out to the beach.
Yeah.
It's fucked. There's reports all the time about somewhere else flooding or something. But life has gone on.
Yeah.
And I found that to be.
And life will go on.
Well, yeah. Well, no, see, this is why I love this book. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to get to it straight away. You can go, it's a bit twee. But
I did not say that. I said the naming of Adam and Noah was twee for me. Your mileage may vary. Yours obviously has.
I love this book because as much as I liked Station 11, yes, I'm going to bring up that book again.
No, I think that's a very clear line to
everyone.
To draw.
Everyone dies, and society and civilization does go backwards. Even though this book is not hopeful, or at least it's not happy, the picture it paints it just feels more realistic, feels feels
less idyllic.
Well,
so everything's going to be nice if we just get rid of technology.
Well, yeah, okay, fine. We're not going to argue Station 11 again.
Let's plant grass by the rain.
No, the fact that we're not going to have essentially an interregnum or a pause where essentially everything collapses and we have to rebuild again. That things will collapse, but things will be also moving along and progressing at the same time. That this stuff runs in parallel. It doesn't all just – and most – I didn't expect a special effect. Did you hear that?
I didn't even have to add that later.
No. And most post-apocalyptic or apocalyptic or slow apocalyptic novels, but mostly the apocalyptic and post ones, have that sort of line where shit happened, we're fucked, and now we're rebuilding again. I like the fact that Bradley doesn't do that, that this is a 50-year look at what happens to the human species, the human, your humankind, and a particular family during this slow decline of the planet.
Yeah, no, I did like that.
Oh, thanks.
You know me, I've been wanting for ages to have the hopeful, or at least the not entirely pessimistic and everyone will eat each other within 5 minutes apocalypse novel.
And you think this
which
does
is why I was
Station
disappointed
11.
With Station 11.
Do you think this does it better than Station 11?
I think
11?
It does do it better than Station 11 because I think Bradley is working with, I'm just going to say it again, much more realistic scenario than, you know, 98% of the planet getting killed by the flu in 3 days.
You could argue, though, that Station 11 is a thought experiment.
Yeah, that's fine.
And this isn't. This is genuinely doing a George Turner real science fiction type approach, which I find very refreshing.
Yes.
And that's why I love the book. It's not the only reason why I love the book. Why are you giving me monosyllabic responses?
No, I just love how you continuing to undermine my continuing criticism of Station 11. This could be a theme.
That will be a thing between us forever.
Not sure we've ever had a book where we're so diametrically opposed.
You never know what the future holds. you never know what the next 20 minutes will hold.
On that note, though, I did read some interviews with James Bradley. Who is a lovely bloke.
Not absolutely disconnected to this book, but he just happens to be a really nice guy. Yes.
And he did in an interview with Carolyn Baum of the Sydney Morning Herald, he did say, I was very definite about not wanting to write an apocalyptic story. And instead he qualifies what his approach to writing as having cautious, clear-eyed optimism. Which I thought was really interesting. So he's like, into this book with the philosophy that it's not good enough to just, you know, scorch to slash and burn, focus on a few plucky survivors who will always, of course, be you and me, Ian, be the ones surviving at the end with our machetes and
our love for Shakespeare.
And a love for fucking Shakespeare, which is what those books and movies and television shows capitalize on. They capitalize on the idea, the very attractive idea. I spoke about this on a panel at a conference a few years ago. The very attractive idea that, you know, everything's fucked. You know, to quote a News Corp sub-editor, world is fucked. you know, everything is fucked. It's too hard. The problems are too hard. It's just, let's just clean slate it and start again. And you and me, we're going to be in the starting again.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's not fun if we're in part of the clean slate. Right. And that's the appeal of those types of books and movies. And I think the zombie apocalypse genre really plays on that. Really, because the survivors often are reduced to their physical capabilities, and it's very hands-on. It's very, you know, and you know, they've got texture and grittiness and stuff you can feel and all of that stuff. So there's an enormous appeal in that. But what Bradley's doing in Clade and what Emily in St. John was doing with Station 11 was the opposite. It was, I mean, Emily St. John did clean slate her world pretty effectively. But it wasn't, you know, survival of the physically fittest necessarily, and everybody, you know, dog eat dog and all that sort of stuff. I mean, there is this optimism, and I think, you know, most, you know, one of the overarching themes of the human race possibly is sometimes stupidly optimism.
Yes.
There will always be a future, and we will always be in that future. It's just what we think.
I agree.
And so what Bradley does in Clade is to sort of take that line of the apocalyptic type world is fucked literature and run with it. And so, okay, well, if there is going to be a here and if we're going to be in it, what do we do?
What does it look like?
Correct. What does it look like?
And what does it mean for – and this is where what you thought was twee, I actually thought was quite resonant. So if you look at
Genesis, I can see the resonance and I think that's why I find
Genesis
it twee.
Genesis is a story. Genesis is a story, yep. And this is what we're taught at school in Jewish land. Genesis
and Christian land.
You don't even know what I was going to say.
Okay.
Genesis is a story about a family.
Yep.
It's about a clade as well.
Yep.
All right. And in fact, you get the whole begatting bit.
Yep.
Oh, and the whole the genealogy from Adam to Noah and all Methuselah and all those.
You skip the begats.
Yeah. No, you don't. That's actually the critical part of that. One of the critical moments of Genesis, Bereshit, is that it very much tells you that that there is a line, that there's a lineage, okay?
Yes,
there's a family. And this is a story about families, and it's a story about dysfunctional families because they all fuck up.
Oh, yeah.
All right? Adam has two sons, one kills the other. Noah, the sons, one of them rapes Noah, sort of. It's debatable. Well, not from the Russell Crowe film. I'm not basing it on that.
No, I'm basing it on the Bible.
Yeah, whatever. Joshua and his brothers, that doesn't go so well. Isaac and Isaac's two sons, Esau and Jacob,
doesn't go too well.
So I like the fact that that clay to a smaller extent does exactly the same thing. This is about a family and it's about parenting and it's about not necessarily getting it right. It's about fucking up. It's about having children who die on you, unfortunately. Which sounds really cold, but it's really sad. Children who leave you because they can't cope with you as a parent or they just whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Children who don't turn out, who have disabilities or have something that's not, doesn't meet the norm. And how do you the challenges and struggles with that. And that's one of the key messages that comes out of Genesis and one of the key messages that comes out of Clade. That's why it had major resonance for me.
Okay.
It just so happens that Genesis is about the beginning of a world. Clade's very much about the decline of a world with a possible beginning.
Yeah.
Which is a lovely inversion on the Genesis story. So Adam and Noah, beautiful.
Okay. And I think for those exact reasons is why I find it a bit twee. Oh. And that's how associations work.
Okay. Where are you leading with this?
I don't know.
That's what the book meant to me. I mean, you want my summary? That's how I think I admit, as a father now, and I keep bringing this up, that there are certain books that are going to have greater impact on me, and this is one of them because it is very much about rearing children to a degree and in an interesting situation because it's not just a kitchen sink drama. Is that how they describe them? I know that's terrible.
Kitchen sink drama.
But it's not set
– Moving on.
The fact that it's set in a world that's in decline just makes that heightens that element of the book for me.
Mm. See, I think one of – and I did like this book, but I did have some problems with it. And I think one of them was that actually with quite a few of the stories, I felt that they could exactly just be in our world. They are exactly that, which doesn't make them bad stories.
I never felt that. I always felt that this was a world that was set 20, 30 years into the future. There was always lovely little hints of the technology that was being used.
Oh, I think his use of neologisms and the way he very lightly threaded them through the book was wonderful. Yeah. I think that was really, really good.
Which sections in particular did you feel were better?
One of the ones was like when Summer, who is Adam and Ellie's daughter, and she's a teenager and she's breaking into rich people's houses with her friends. Which was a nice little story and it was quite dynamic, but I didn't feel like that had a lot to say about this book. Like that could have been kids now breaking into the houses of wealthier people that they knew. It didn't, and I think it missed an opportunity. It really did miss an opportunity to talk about what is and what will become an even wider divide between the haves and the have-nots in our world.
Well, I thought that was what that section was doing.
I honestly couldn't see any difference. Like, I didn't see the reason for this thing to be in the, I don't think it drummed that home enough.
Okay.
And I think maybe this is just where I'm possibly at odds with James Bradley. Cause in the same interview in the Sydney Morning Herald, another thing he said was, he said, talking about his own personal anger and frustration with, the environmental issues and climate change and so on. he said, channeling some of it into Clade, but I hope it's muted and that I am expressing concern rather than rage. And I think a lot of the time I would have wanted just a little bit more of a shift towards rage here and there. I think the book was very it felt very placid in a way.
No,
and I don't mean that in a
I know where you're going here, but I cannot agree with you because I think the sections that deal with immigration, with the internment of people who are foreigners because of the growing refugee problem that occurs, I think there's a certain amount of anger in those sections. In fact, I'm going to try and find something.
Yeah, the story.
There's a certain amount of anger in those sections.
I don't know. One of the strengths of the book is that it uses this particular structure. So it takes the adult lifespan of a human being and has this lineal, I think Bradley refers to it as a geological novel, just in terms of the span.
Yep.
And I guess like the layering of things. And that's a great strength of how he's crafted the book. And I think one of the weaknesses that brings with it is because he is using the idea of clade and a familial structure, and this is one family's lineage, he's missing the aspects of society who will, in a very direct way, suffer the worst.
No, he's not. It's
all covered, but a lot of the time it feels like when you're watching the news, it is happening to people who are not the people of the story. Like even I think the weakest chapter.
So you had the same criticism to Station 11.
I think the weakest chapter is actually the one writing-wise with Lee, the girl whose mother goes to China and dies. Because again, as I said, the structure of the book, he's stuck with this family and the people who move directly into their sphere.
So you mean the Journal of the Plague Year?
A Journal of the Plague Year. And like, I want to go to China. I want to see the girl's mother and her family and how she's coping. This is a really the journal. I don't think this is this particular story.
China,
no, wait. Let me finish.
Okay, all right.
This particular story, I think, is the weakest in the book. And I think it's perhaps emblematic of the problem I have with the book, in that it's meant to be the journal of a teenage girl. It reads very much like it's the only book that's in first person because it is meant to be literally this written down journal that she started to keep on her 16th birthday, and is written in the same style as the rest of the book, which are third person stories about Adam and Ellie and the family. Gives great swathes of dialogue interchange, which I always hate in journals and so on, unless there's a very good reason for having them there, but there isn't here. It's a bad journal. Like, it's a bad replication of a 16-year-old girl writing a journal. But it does mirror the rest of the style of the book, and it stays within the clade structure. And it feels – one of the reasons I didn't like that chapter so much was that it felt – For a journal, a first-person intimate diary that she's keeping for herself, there was no intimacy. I didn't feel her worry about her mother. Like, I didn't feel on a visceral level. It's like written there, you know, I'm worried about mom. I haven't heard from her in a few days. And there's one thing to say if she was talking to people, she might say things like that because she's, you know, trying. But this is her journal that she's not writing for anyone but herself.
It's very hard for me to argue this point that you're making.
But you see the point I'm making.
Yeah, I see the point you're making.
And for me, like, I think that story fails as a story. It was also just a huge sidestep to bring this character into the clade thing. It's like we've never come across the girl's mother before even, and suddenly it's like, oh, and by the way, my mum babysat this boy and now she's gone to China and I have to go babysit this boy. It's like, it's awkward. It's an awkward connection. And I think that, and this journal, for this story for me, which is, you know, I will maintain is a failed story.
Because it's got lots of dialogue.
It does not feel like the journal of a 16-year-old girl who is writing a journal for herself, whose mother has just gone to China, left her to care for a strange boy who she's never met before. And by strange, I mean like unknown, not, you know, odd, although he's
autistic.
Odd as well because he's autistic. and whose mother is gone and she's alone. And there's none of that visceral anxiety and worry about her mother. Again, it's like it's a told story. You could take the dates out and it's a told story. It doesn't have any of the feeling of a journal and the intimacy and fracturedness and all of that. It's very thought out. Yeah, it was my least favorite story, even though I thought it could have been one of the most powerful because it was one of the few that took you outside of the family, even though she was quickly brought in.
You say you didn't have a visceral reaction, yet I did. So this is where I can't argue the point because it's purely subjective.
Yeah, and a lot of this will be. And I think this is the problem. It's the same reaction we had with Station 11.
Yeah, you could pick apart a plot. And the reason why I had I found that section to be actually quite interesting and powerful is that I do think she worries about her mother. Yes, it's not every page and not every journal entry because there are things going on. I think if you'd set that in China, it would have just been, oh, a plague's here and people are dropping like flies.
No, because that's the thing. No.
And that's not the story he's telling.
That's when a good writer doesn't just go, oh, it's another plague story. Like, I mean,
you could question, does this book need a plague story? We've done the plague trope or whatever you want to call it, storyline a gazillion times. But what I loved is that it's just a section
of a much larger
tapestry. Although this is not a long book. It's only a 60,000.
It is a very small book, actually.
But this is just one.
It weaves in.
Yeah, okay. So it gives an insight into because it interweaves the technological side and how an autistic boy in this era would how he would experience the world around him through these images that you can create and all this sort of vague virtual reality stuff, which I found interesting. Yes, she's a fish out of water sort of character in that her mum never heard of.
Yep.
She's just appeared. Who the hell is she? Well, I think we get a feel for who she is.
No, we do. What I'm saying is when the structure of the book and how it's set up, it's a reach to bring her in because he needed to bring her in. So with this, what I'm saying, like the choices, like as I've always said, as an author, you make choices about how you're going to tell a story. And every choice you make because it has certain strengths and it's the right choice to make. But every choice is going to have weaknesses that you need to deal with.
It's just another section on parenting.
I know. I guess what I'm saying is I don't know. I appreciate the structure of the book. And because of that, it's a bit unfair to criticize a lack of different viewpoints. And yet I feel the need to criticize that. I think the story where the family, illegal in inverted commas, immigrant family, refugee family have to take their daughter to hospital because the daughter's going to die.
I thought that was amazing.
That's an amazing story. Outside of this book, if you forget Clade.
Yeah.
Forget Clade. If you just read that story somewhere in an anthology, would you not think he chose the wrong point of view character? I want to see that family. I want to know what that family is doing. Why is he choosing this woman who's a friend of some guy they know?
But that's the point.
It is not a novel. It is a collection of short stories.
It is a debatable point. It is absolutely a novel.
It is.
In the literary world, this would be considered a novel. Mosaic novel, it might be called, but it is a novel. It is not an independent set of short stories that are set.
As a novel, I'm not sure it's cohesive enough.
Absolutely,
so I'm happy to think of it as interlinked short stories and a progression, and especially as it's linear, that one that builds, and that's absolutely fine. I'm just pointing out, I think, some of the weaknesses in those links.
Okay, I hear what you're saying.
And again, this is not, like, this is how he has structured the novel. So he could not do it in a way, because if he structured a novel that was like, for example, I can't believe I'm bringing this up, World War Z. From all different viewpoints all over the place, it would have been a different novel. I think James Bradley would have written a much better novel than Max Brooks did. So, I'm not necessarily saying that that's a criticism of how he's written the novel. I'm just saying for me that it felt like it just, like, because of that aspect, it just didn't grapple as much. Because also, I mean, the world building and the very gentle introduction of new technology and all that sort of stuff.
The section that feels a bit like a Black Mirror episode, Echo, where it's about people creating
the imagery of
that
reminded me of Black Mirror. It's like, oh, that's that Black Mirror episode.
That section, I suppose, of all of them could probably be taken out of this book and dealt with as a separate short story. I actually thought
it took me ages to even find the link in that story between Like, I had to go back and go,
That David Mitchell aspect of this novel, which I loved.
No, and all that is fine.
And you're going to call David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas not a novel because it's a whole bunch of...
No, I've not read Cloud Atlas. Well, all I'm saying is this was one of the things that I found distancing about the book. I'm not saying, like, for what he was doing, that this was something he couldn't do.
You felt that the point of... It seems to me you felt that... In some of the key moments, the point of view character, because of the constraints he placed on himself, wasn't the one that you would have found interesting.
It wasn't at the heart of that story. As I said to you, it reminded me at times of watching the news. This is stuff that's happening to other people.
No, it's
and
no,
that's I, kind of no. the because he's well, here's one of the things.
And what about the monsoon that they go through? I mean,
yeah. No, yes, yes. The in with Noah and the flood.
Yeah,
yes. No, I'm not saying nothing happens to them. What I'm saying is it's not a huge scope. And for a book which could have had a huge scope, it is not bringing that to the table for me. Now, for you, the intimacy of the family stuff is what's winning out, and that's fine. I'm saying for me, that's not enough. I'm saying I wanted a bigger scope. I'm saying that
You are doing the worst thing of all. You are critiquing the book that was not written.
But it is setting itself up as being a big scope book.
No, it's setting itself up. No, absolutely not. It's setting itself up as a book about a family, a Clay. It's the fucking novel. Yeah, it's called Clay.
Yeah. But it's a book that is, you know, often through exposition, talking about the whole world and the effects on the whole world.
Because they exist in a place.
And not just as off to the side.
No, they exist in a place. If families are going to exist during climate change, we're not going to be in every moment. It's not a tapestry. This is not this tapestry where it's going to look at different families in different parts of the world.
I know. And I just said that. I said it's the structure of the book, which is its strength, but also has weaknesses. And, I was trying to say something.
Sorry, I didn't mean to.
Damn it, I had a point. You let my point escape. Okay. So, for example, when you're talking about, the chapter at the end with the girls at the rave and all the overlays and stuff they're seeing and the way technology is woven through the book and all of that's really fine, but a lot of the reading that you do about future scenarios and how climate change is going to affect the world, actually there's going to be – it's not going to be ubiquitous technology. There'll be an even wider gulf between people who have access to it and people who don't. And the way people who don't live will be vastly different. The people who are going to be, as I said, hit hardest and in the most savage way by climate change are not in this book in a direct way. And I feel that for me was one of the concerns. So it's enough to talk about how, because again, like to give an example, there's a bit, and I forget which story is in because as you know, titles and names are, they don't stick in my head, where he, one of the characters or the narrator actually, because they're all third person, he's talking about how, there was crop failures and famines and hundreds of millions of people died. And it's written just like that. And again, like it's like a bit from the news. It's this thing. And I don't know. I enjoyed reading this book. I just felt that the world building itself wasn't presented as well as it could have been. When you talk about all the birds are gone and yet there's not this, like, all the birds are gone? Fuck, man, the world's dead. Like, you know, there were these little nods to things that are happening and I don't think there
The world is dead, but the world's not dead.
Then the birds aren't gone. This is what I'm saying to you. If the birds are gone, the world's fucked. Like, this is not the world if the birds are gone.
Well, I don't know.
Because there are huge, like, one of the things that this book is talking about.
You're saying through that's the a scientific word, plot hole.
I'm saying this is a world-building failure, right? I'm saying, now, I'm willing to go as far as thinking, okay, when characters say all the birds are gone, they don't mean all the birds are gone. What they mean is the seagulls are gone or something.
I thought the line was, yes, the birds are gone, but that there's less procreation, less,
But one of the things that this book does really well, and it does it in its structure and the way it sets the world up, is it does present things as a system, right? So dominoes fall, things over, you know, butterfly wings, the whole lot, right? And yet some of the world building is so offhand that you go, but why? You just can't say the birds are gone and have her on the beach with otherwise okay. Like there's massive implications to things like that.
So scientist lady. I've now just objectified you.
and I just wanted
the birds,
more.
I don't know enough. So the birds going, what should that mean?
Well, if all the birds are gone,
yeah, they're all gone.
You don't have dissemination of a lot of seeds and grasses. You don't have key predator species getting fed. You don't.
And how much of that can be replaced with technology?
Almost none. Do you know about the bees? Let me tell you the story about the bees. So bees, as you probably know, like accelerated colony collapse disorder. So in China, because the bees were all dying and dead and they take on a massive volume of our agricultural system. If we don't have bees, we are seriously in trouble. And I'm speaking very seriously, people. We are fucked if there are no bees. And that's something that Clade emphasizes very well. So they started to pay people to pollinate plants. And they found that, people are actually more efficient because they will pollinate every flower, whereas bees kind of scatter around. But the problem is people cost more. And then there were also side effects that they didn't even think about because everything is an ecosystem and one thing shifts and another thing shifts. And one of the things I didn't get with this book was I never got a point where I went, holy shit, of course that would happen. Because this has happened and that's happened, so that would totally happen. And I have never thought about that ever. You know, I didn't feel like it was presenting that. And as you say,
science is not my area of expertise, so I'll have to accept that world building.
But he did, like, he obviously, there's so much research filtering through this book. And for the most part, it's really well done. There's not a huge amount of telling, there are some awkward bits, but mostly it's quite well done. And I think there were some missed opportunities because one of the things when you're talking about, you know, a changing world, especially when you're looking at a literal generational story, there were missed opportunities with connections between those generations. So, for example, when the story where Adam takes Noah and Lee to the beach house during the pandemic. And Lee goes out and there are no birds and she puts on the overlays and some sound and she imagines what it would be like.
Yep.
And that's a really – like it's a poignant moment. How much better would that have been if actually Adam was out there going – showing – like if there was this interaction between the person who knew about that firsthand and had lost it and the person who'd never known it.
That could be between, though.
If you had that interaction between them.
Kirsten.
There's not a lot of interaction between.
Kirsten.
And that's the thing I found frustrating. It's like you've got this canvas, you've got these people, you've got a story about family and optimism and love and humanity will, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he's just missing.
No, he's not.
Some
this
of
is a dysfunctional
moments.
Family. Adam is not that sort of character. This is a dysfunctional family. This is not a family that
I'm not talking about an overly sentimental thing. I'm talking about like Adam just being out there and saying, yeah, you know, there used to be birds.
Okay,
instead of the narrator telling you there used to be birds. You know, that's what I'm missing. I'm missing these fine-grained connections.
All right. And I'm saying this. I'm saying that this is very much a Western point of view and a Western take
it is.
On an apocalypse. Yes. There's an element of reportage to the disasters that are happening elsewhere, although they do happen through the Western world.
Yep.
The monsoon section is in
the that's one of my favourite bits, the monsoon, that section. That's really
good. I thought that was an amazing moment, just the tension of it and just everything about
it. Anyway. And the building of that relationship between Adam and Ellie and Jonah. When I say the building of the relationship, I don't mean like, oh, it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah,
I mean the construction of that dynamic between them is so good.
But I don't think I can criticise this book. For taking the perspective it takes.
No.
Because it's a perfectly valid perspective. Yes, okay, you could have got any more interesting. No, well, you could have got a more interesting story out of what happened in China, out of the immigration side of things. But I think one of the problems we've got is that we don't take a serious, in the Western world, we don't take a seriously enough look from our own reactions to these things. So we hear about Bangladesh, a million people have died in a mudslide.
But we didn't even have, what I'm saying is like I said the thing about the journal thing could have been set in China, and that's because I felt that particular story just stuck out anyway for various reasons, as I said. But even within Australia, if you're just going to set everything within Australia in this one family, it didn't penetrate. When you talked about class earlier, it didn't penetrate those class structures. It didn't show you what people in Australia are going to have to
– Well, it does.
The people it showed you were immigrant people, which – is definitely one of the aspects. What I'm saying is it's positioning them as the other. They're the refugees. They're the people who've come from the outside.
It shows a government that will do what a proper government will do, which is to placate its white Western
Absolutely,
its white
but
populace.
It's making the assumption that the refugees who are coming, or the illegals as they're termed in the book, are this othered group who are coming, and we can deal with them and accept them or not and all this stuff, but they're still these. And the assumption rests on the idea that the rest of us, as you just said, us rest of us in Australia are doing okay. And what I'm saying is most of us would not be okay.
No, I didn't say that. I did not say that. And this family is not doing okay for a variety of reasons.
They're materially doing okay.
They may be privileged.
And this is what I'm talking about.
But I think it's interesting to get
not questioning like the technology that goes through it. It does have like in Breaking and Entering, the story where they break into the rich people's houses. Like, again, that would have been a perfect opportunity to kind of filter in a bit more of this. And I don't know. As I said, I liked the book. I liked reading it.
It doesn't sound like you like the book, frankly. I mean,
when I really hate a book, I don't actually pull it to pieces this badly. I just dismiss it. But no, I just think there were just some missed opportunities there. And it's a shame. But I will say, James. And the other thing is, I need to point out too that something I think you sometimes have trouble differentiating between, especially when it's something you really love.
Yes, like this.
There is a difference between critiquing a book based on, for example, I'm talking about the technical aspects of that journal story.
Okay, you're right. And there's
right
yeah,
between
fair.
That, which yeah. I'm saying, you know, from a fairly objective viewpoint.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
It's a weak thing. It should have been done better. Here's some examples of how you could have done it better. And me saying, here's how I connected or didn't connect with the book, which is not necessarily a huge criticism of this book.
I'm not attacking that you didn't resonate with me. And I'm not attacking that. But you are making statements about, well, this would have been more interesting if this had happened.
And these are the reasons why I didn't connect with the book.
All right. And right?
I'm not objectively saying it's a crap book because it didn't do this.
It's very hard.
Yeah.
For me to argue that, to some of these points, because they're purely subjective. I get that.
And that's so we're having a discussion now about how we each connected differently to this book and why.
I have not personally read a book that's – I mean, because, you know, there's all the stuff about IVF, which, you know, that was interesting. Mm. And there's the stuff about the child, the boy that dies. And,
yep.
and again, these are – tragic moments in a declining world, and I haven't seen those things joined together.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen a book that's so focused on the challenges of parenting that's more than just helicopter parents and all that sort of shit, that actually is looking at the dysfunctional, in a sense a dysfunctional family, but a family that still has love that runs through it, much like, as I go back to Genesis, because that actually comes to me. Now, yes, is there some failures in the world building? Maybe there are. Frankly, the birds thing that, dissemination of seeds, da-da-da. Yeah, look, you've probably got a good point there. And if people comment on this podcast, they can say whether Kirsten's right or wrong. I don't know.
Oh, stop
no,
it.
No, well, you're probably right. Okay. No, fine. But I know we get a bit shaky about this, but I actually do like that this is very much a middle class to privileged perspective on what happens during the decline of this planet. With that element of reportage, that element of things happening that haven't a connection to me, but they're not that actually the next day I, in a sense, can forget about it, sort of.
Mm.
Not that these characters necessarily do, but the one with the girl in the hospital one, and the Ellie, it's Ellie gets involved in that, and she does does play a role, but in a sense, she could have just walked away as well.
Yep.
I found that interesting. How much are we as a Western culture going to invest in our, because we fucking caused the problem in the first place, how much are we going to invest in saving the planet, or at least helping those who are disenfranchised as a result? Yes, could there have been more on the lower stratas of the white people who and just Australians generally? Yeah, probably there could have been. Yes. I don't know if the book is trying to do that, but...
No, it's not. All I'm doing is putting forth reasons for why I did not connect to this book as strongly as you did.
Okay.
As I said, it's not the book he wrote, so I'm not trying to say... He should have done this. He should have done
this.
I'm just saying I didn't connect to it, and I've been thinking about why.
Yeah, okay.
Because it's a book like with Station 11.
I'm sorry if I jumped down your throat.
Like with Station 11, it's a book that went on the face of it, I went, I should love this book, and I didn't. So then I started to think, well, why didn't I?
It's interesting on Station 11 how many people have agreed with you and have said.
Oh, really? I thought mostly people agreed with you.
No, it's quite a few people. I mean, Cheryl Morgan attacked me on Twitter when we did the podcast.
Oh, man, Cheryl.
And Noel Harrison has agreed. You know, a bunch of people have said that for the same reasons that you've raised.
And.
And the they'll probably be the same here. But
the other thing is also, and this is a really important point that I think should be made, this is a fairly new genre. This is becoming scarily less science fiction than real life. I mean, as you said, one of the things you really liked about it and one of the things that I found distancing was that, and possibly this is around our expectations of the book, is that you thought it was all about the family backgrounded against the climate thing, where I came to this book thinking it was going to be really looking at how climate change is affecting the world on a macro level.
Yeah.
Sorry, on a micro level.
Well, both. Yeah,
on a macro, on a micro level. Yeah. And, oh, it was actually mostly about the family and a very particular family, and the climate change stuff was background. And so part of that is expectation. And what I wanted to say is, as more of these types of books get written, the field, the genre as a whole will become more diverse.
And
it's the diversity argument, right? It's not fair. And I know, I think, and I do apologize, James, because I may have come across being, you know, as expecting your book to be the one book on climate change in Australia from a domestic perspective. And it obviously can't be, and no book can be. And I think this is a really good book, and it's an important part of the conversation. And I'm looking forward to there being more books with different aspects and books that I might connect to differently than I did with Clay.
I think what those books looking into the future will lack that this one has is that sense of wonder. Because I love the fact that the very last section of the novel is about the possibility that there's life on other planets.
Are you going to throw something at me if I say...
You didn't like that, did you?
A little bit twee.
Oh, my God.
I not even twee, actually.
It's not confirmed,
you know what? That's the wrong
the
word.
Point is,
that's the wrong
the point is it's not confirmed.
Well,
I
like that the point actually was, because Noah thinks it is confirmed. But you know what? The point is, even if it is, it doesn't fucking matter.
Well, that's
true. Because
there
are billions of temporal years from ever making contact. So they might be out there.
I suppose I go to a more fannish reason for this, which is in an environment we live in where we're told that people on the left or moderates or whatever are writing all these dull message fic books that have none of that old 1950s sense of wonder about them. Here is a book.
This is a Hugo Award nominee.
Well,
you're saying.
The sad puppy should be
this
all over
please
this.
Please, everybody, look, possible aliens.
Yeah, well, they won't
at
be
at some point.
They won't all be all over this because most of them are climate change deniers. But no, I've just joked.
Oh, no, stop it.
I know. Well, Vox
cut
day,
that
Vox
one
days.
Out.
Okay, because it does marry together both that message fix stuff and apocalypse and bloody blah and climate change with that sense of wonder that science fiction does so well in a way that I think is really, really touching.
Yeah. No, I like that. I bridled a little at the idea that some of our optimism should come from the old idea of, well, we're not alone in the universe. And it's like, so what if we are? In fact, if we are, it's more fucking important that we take care of the diversity of life that has somehow formed on this planet. If we're the only ones.
I think it's more an aspect of shame on our part. It's shame.
I get.
If there is life on other worlds and they do come or they get contact, millions of years later,
we're going to be in such fucking trouble.
But how embarrassing and shameful.
That's what I mean. Like, we're just going to be sent to our room for the rest of our lives.
I don't think that section is about Noah going, oh, fuck. You're right. Because, like you said, there's no lifeboat here.
No, it's more the emotional resonance of not feeling alone in the universe, quite literally. And I appreciated
and
that.
And it's part of the larger...
It just didn't...
This is the twee bit. It's part of the
larger
clade.
Yeah. Yes, and it just didn't quite... Well, they might not be... In fact, they're almost certainly not descendants.
Antecedents. But we're all citizens of the universe. So...
Oh, dear. Okay, now you just made it twee.
That's right. But
you know what? Also, I just want to pick up on something you said before we ended, and I know you didn't mean it this way, so I'm not attacking you, but you know, you were just talking about how, oh, this book is message fiction, but it's also got this.
Yeah.
I just, again, I guess probably because we started talking about sad puppies earlier.
Oh, I hate the whole message fiction.
Every single thing has a message.
No, I know. And there's
if you think your thing doesn't have a message, the message is simply that you didn't think about what the fuck you were saying.
Now people are in that sort of sad puppy land and going, no, there's a difference between fiction with a message and message fiction. And they're starting to make these sort of categorization errors.
No, there's no categorization error.
Well, it's
bullshit.
It's bullshit.
I mean, definitely there's didactic fiction. Absolutely. That falls across the whole
political
spectrum.
But it's been there for 300 years.
And I'm about to say, it has been there since the beginning. And was, you know, but that's whether fiction is poorly or badly written or whether fiction has an explicit purpose
correct
to be didactic or not. it's not about, well, this has a message I don't like, therefore it's message fiction. But this book, which I love, just happens to have a message with the story. It's like, oh, fuck off. Sorry. Well, you said message fiction and my hackles rose. Did you see them? They rose.
They rose. We end the podcast then with a line that this book resonated with me quite a lot, less so with you.
Less so with me, but I liked it. It's a good book.
And it starts a discussion.
And I want to say, well, that's what I was going to say. I want to say again and make this really clear, because I know I also have an issue where if I've got things I don't particularly like about a book, I think a lot of us, that's all I talk about, there's a lot I liked about this book. And as a whole, like stepping back from what's inside the covers and just looking at the book as an object.
It is a novel.
I think it's an incredibly important book, not least of all because it has gotten a lot of exposure here. It has been part of a conversation. And if a lot of people are reading this book, it's become a conversation that people are very happy to have. And they're happy to have it in their art. They're happy to have it in their politics. They're happy to have it. And that's the important thing. I do love how the only time this book ever mentioned, because I guess it became very evident in the narrative of the book that it was obviously climate change was real, was at the very beginning where Adam is having a rant about the media wanting to present both sides. And I love that. I love that.
Well, I love also a little bit later on when it's fucking obvious it's climate change, you're still deniers.
Yes, exactly.
And you know that'll be the case. You know that even when the fucking stream of lava's coming down the road, there'll people go, it's not.
It's not man-made.
It's not man-made.
Actually, that probably wasn't lava.
Well, you get what I'm saying. Yes. A bit of hyperbole never hurt anyone.
It does. That's the problem. Hyperbole does hurt.
Are we wrapping up?
So I am really glad I read this book. I'm a little personally sad. I didn't connect with it as I hoped I would when I started it.
I love the fact that it is a Genesis retelling. No, it's I love the fact. No, I actually love the fact that it riffs a bit on Genesis. Good on him. Good on him. Without making it overtly religious.
Good on you, James.
No, without making it overtly religious by doing something really smart. I'm sorry.
But doesn't it then become tacitly religious by
relying
on the knowledge of that to actually resonate?
Well, that's something I picked up. It's obviously something you thought was twee and didn't give a shit about. But
Ian, calm down. I'm having a go.
You're stirring me.
Just stirring.
Okay. You are so Anyway, the next episode of this podcast, if we want to still be friends, will be recorded in front of a live studio audience.
I didn't write that. I said panel.
Yes, it will be our annual continuum podcast. So it will be in front of a live panel.
Hopefully, I love these.
I love how you put in brackets, hopefully a continuum 11. Is there an...
No, hopefully as in live audience.
Oh, they're not dead. Good. Yeah, no
corpses. Or just there. You know, they're there. It's not us in an empty room.
We'll get at least two or three people.
Some people
sleep in the room. So
we have two awesome guests, so we are definitely going to get a good audience.
Well, can I get to that?
You can get to that.
So a continuum 11 over the long weekend of 5 to 8 June. We're not entirely sure when ours will be.
I haven't received a confirmation yet.
But it'll be one of those days.
It'll be the Saturday or the Sunday.
Okay, so
I just don't know which or what time, but we will put that all over Twitter and everything when we do find out.
Our special guest on the podcast, Kirsten, I don't know if you're aware of this, who we've invited.
No, no idea.
Well, this will be a
I
shock.
I did not print out that.
Obviously the guest of honour of the...
Yay.
Of the
well, that's become tradition, hasn't
that's
it?
That's become traditional, yes. Tansy Rayner Roberts and RJ Anderson. And they've chosen the following books, and I don't know if you're aware of this either.
Now you're being twee.
Well, that's the most used word in this podcast. Tansy's is Growing Rich by Faye Weldon.
Which I'm really excited about.
Are you as excited by Rebecca's choice?
Only because I had not heard of the book before.
All right. It's The King of Atolia by Megan Whalen Turner, the third volume in a series, but as... because we questioned or interrogated her, actually. I was quite rude.
You
I've
were a bit
say.
Rude.
I was a bit abrupt.
Yes.
Because I said...
is that a third book? Are you making us read a third book? Yeah. Why would you make us read a third book?
Why would you do that? WTF. Is it self-contained? Will I get it? She's assured us that yes. It is obviously...
Well, she assured us that the fact that it was a third book would not be the reason why you didn't get it.
Correct. And also that... Ms. Megan Whalen Turner has about 23 years between books, and so she needs to actually remind.
So it should stand alone and be relatively self-contained.
Feedback and comments, because the footy's about to start.
Oh, so, God, the footy.
We're going to lose anyway. It's Carlton Essendon. Anyway, you can comment at the website at writerandcritic.podbean.com. You can email us at writerandcritic@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, writerandcritic. And, iTunes. algorithms get
you've
us
given up on iTunes, yeah, haven't you?
Well, I don't even look at it. So,
oh, you don't?
No, the guy on the gist, he does look. He reads
there was all. A time when you looked every week.
Yeah, there was a time.
And told me about it.
Yes, I don't do that now. I've grown up.
No, you don't.
That's been a fun podcast.
That has been. I like podcasts with books that make us talk and think.
Yeah, unlike the ones where we just sit here silently and mumble to each other.
Well, no, I mean, sometimes you read a book and you go, oh, that was a good book. And that's about all I got to say about it.
Yeah.
So, we're done.
That's it for me. Bye.
Bye.
Why, though, do you keep glaring at me? You just like glaring
I'm
at me.
I'm just tired.
And you're blaming most of that on me.
No, I just...
Yes, have, you did in the car. You blame most of it on me.
I have resting bitch face when I'm tired, so...
What the fuck is resting bitch face? Oh, that.
You've okay. never heard of resting bitch no. face.
No.
That's when someone, usually a woman, because we're in a sexist world...
Yes.
...doesn't look entirely happy when they're just, you know, at rest.
Ah, that explains a lot about
and in
Jews.
Fact, they actually look grumpy or cross or, you know... Whatever is that gendered when, interpretation you want to put onto
is that when the
face of a woman
husband,
who's not actually smiling.
Is that when the partner and husband then keep saying, because I do, are you all right? Is everything okay? And they go, yes, leave me alone. And then they actually get angry.
Then they have active bitch face.
Yes. Gotcha.